Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Summer is almost here, technically, but we had a tough May as far as the weather was concerned in central Ohio and beyond, and that makes a bird's life maybe a little bit more of a challenge. We're going to talk today about how birds manage bad weather and baby bird season and much, much more, because joining us today is naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zickafoos. We'll post a link to her blog at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Julie joins us by phone. Welcome, Julie.
Well, it's so great to be back with you, Ann.
Happy almost summer.
Oh, it is. It feels like full summer to me.
Yeah, it does to me, too. It was beautiful weather this past weekend, but that we've had some rough times, though.
We have. I'm thinking of that derecho that came roaring through Ohio May 15th, and just, oh, it was devastating out our way. We lost probably 30 trees on our property, and many of them falling in very, very bad places. So it's something that it's so overwhelming, I can't really even think about it right now.
And when you're out in kind of the middle of nowhere like you are, it's more isolating than ever.
Yeah. And I realize, you know, that living on a property in the country is really all about the plants. The plants are in charge. You have to have equipment to fight back the plants. And if you don't have a large tractor with many, many, many horsepower and a mowing deck and somebody who can run a chainsaw and a weed whacker, you will be subsumed. And this is the year that we all find that out, because it's just, there's been so much rain and these violent storms, and the plants are saying, ah, this is the edge we needed to take over.
Right, because in some ways it's been good for plants.
Yeah, I mean, there's an amazing summer wildflower display going on right now because there's been so much rain, and the somewhat cooler temperatures have been nice for a lot of plants. I guess what I'm referring to is that when a tree falls mm-hmm. on an area that you had formerly been mowing with a tractor, mm-hmm. You have to deal with that. You have to, like, chainsaw that thing up and find a way to haul it away, or you can't mow there anymore. And then what happens underneath the tree that has fallen is a nursery springs up of shrubs and trees that within a couple of years becomes an impenetrable barrier. Mm-hmm. So it's very daunting, and I've been afraid a few times this spring because I just feel like it's more than I can deal with.
Are you going to learn to use a chainsaw?
No, I am not. I am too old, and I will cut something off that I need to work with, like my hand. I do have lines, and chainsaw is one of them. However, I am learning how to use a weed whacker, and I'm not loving it, but I'm beginning to get, I'm not going to say competent, but I'm beginning to get slightly more comfortable with it.
Now, you've had some, it's been a beautiful spring. By the way, I'm talking with naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zickafoos by phone. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos, you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's still, all things being equal, spring, and this is when birds are having baby birds. And you just posted a incredible shot from a baby from a bluebird's nest. I mean,
yeah.
What a shot!
Yeah, it really, even for me, who's been opening bluebird boxes for over 35 years, that was a moment for me. It depicts a just hatched baby bluebird with its tiny pink wing nubs spread, and one is resting on a pipping egg, and the other is resting on another pipping egg, and its little sibling is sort of curled down beneath it, and it's got its bill open. And it, to me, that was sort of a metaphorical, I am here, this is my moment, you know, photo of this tiny little nub of a bluebird that in 17 or 18 days will be flying. And that miracle just never, ever leaves me. It's always with me.
We have a sound of an eastern bluebird. Let's listen to that. You and I talked about eastern bluebirds last time, and I mentioned that we finally have attracted them to our yard using dried mealworms, and you said there was something about mealworms you wanted to talk about, and we never got to it. What's going on with that?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, first, before I talk about mealworms, I need to preface it with the comment that, from my experience working with bluebirds since the early 80s, they are addictive personalities. They would be the junkies of the bird world. And so bluebirds like an easy meal, and they like an abundant food source. And if you give them that, they will convince you that you are their sole means of support. and that, so they're panhandlers, they're freeloaders. Uh-huh. And you know, we don't want to think that about our beloved bluebirds, but they really are. So what a lot of people fall into is a trap where they get to thinking that they're the only means of support for these bluebirds who are coming for mealworms to their yard. Mm-hmm. And that's fun for the person, but it isn't necessarily so good for the bluebird.
Okay.
And the reason is that mealworms are very high in fat and phosphorus, and they are very low in calcium. And they just have, they're not a good 100% steady diet. It would be sort of like if you decided you were only going to eat peanuts, you know?
Yeah.
And that would be all you eat, you know? And so you're getting something from these peanuts, but they aren't giving you everything you need.
Okay.
So we just need to be careful and not overdo it with bluebirds and mealworms, and that includes the dried ones. It's wonderful to be able to put out a treat to train these birds to come in, you know, with your voice. It's very flattering to our human egos, but to keep it a treat. And the rule of thumb I say to people is don't give a bluebird any more than 8 mealworms at a meal.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, okay. So that's, you know, that's not a lot. And a lot of people put them out sort of ad libitum, and that's not good for the bluebirds, especially during the summer. Yeah.
Well, we don't as much anymore anyway, because they also attract grackles.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, lots of things like mealworms. It's when you put out the candy. It's neat to establish a relationship through food, but it's not cool to co-opt the bird's metabolisms with one food that they're just gorging on. And I've done it myself. I've done it wrong, so I know what happens.
Mm-hmm.
What happened with me is I decided one summer, since I was growing my own mealworms in these great big plastic footlockers, I thought, what would happen if I put out all the mealworms that these bluebirds want? And this was way back when. This was maybe early 90s. And I did that. And I had a pair of bluebirds in my yard here in Ohio that nested 4 times, raised 4 broods of babies. And that's too many. They were exhausted by the end of the summer. But the thing that happened to them that really got my attention was that they failed to molt in August. Molting is where a bird drops all its feathers and then replaces them with new ones. So these birds lost their feathers and didn't grow new ones. So they looked like a couple of little ragamuffins with bald heads and tattered wings, and they looked terrible. And I realized that I had encouraged them through this superabundance of food to raise so many chicks that their own metabolisms, they had failed to take care of themselves. So they were messed up. So I tapered off the food, and by October, they had finally molted and replaced their feathers, or they were going to freeze to death in the winter. And I promised them I'd never be that dumb again.
Okay, well, I won't either. everybody else out there, you too. You know, it was a late spring. Does that affect bird behavior when it comes to nesting and laying?
Absolutely. It's been such an interesting spring for me. I would say I've been keeping records on my bluebirds all the time I've been working with them. I have 25 boxes, and I keep close records on when they initiate nesting, when they lay eggs, when their babies hatch. And this spring, they're 2.5 to 3 weeks later than any other spring I've recorded.
Wow.
Yeah. And I believe that that has to do with food as much as it does with temperature and weather. And I think that what happened was they were unable to find sufficient food to ensure them that they could raise their babies. So here's a case in point. I have a box out in the orchard where on the 22nd of April, I found a full bluebird nest with no lining. That means that there's still a couple more days to go. When they line the nest with fine hair and grasses, then they are ready to lay the eggs. the female is ready to lay the eggs. That's the last thing she does before she lays. So I figure she probably started laying right after the 22nd of April. By the 30th of April, she had a full clutch of 5 eggs. Now, normally, you reach into a box, you see a full clutch of 5 eggs, they're going to be warm. These things were sitting there cold, and that's very unusual.
Huh.
Because the bluebird normally starts incubating with the third egg she lays. So by the time she has a clutch of 5, she's been sitting for a couple of days. So on the 2nd of May, which is 3 days later, the 5 eggs were still cold. I'd never seen that before.
Does that mean they're going to die?
No. The cool thing. They keep, just like chicken eggs in your fridge. They keep. And the crazy thing is that even if she had started incubation, she could have left them for a week or more, and the embryos would have just said, well, mom's gone. Okay, we'll wait. And they would have gone into a sort of a dormancy without dying. But she finally began incubating on the 8th of May, which is crazy, crazy late. She should have been hatching those eggs probably by the 1st of May. So she began incubating on the 8th of May, and she didn't hatch them again. You know, 14 days later they hatched. So that's what's been going on in a lot of my bluebird boxes, where they would initiate nests, not lay eggs, or lay eggs, wait. And the lesson to anyone running nest boxes, being a bluebird landlord, is the birds know best. Don't second guess them.
What? How does that change the rest of the season for the bluebirds?
Yeah, it's basically going to be falling dominoes all summer long.
Yeah.
Because I just now, that photo that you referred to of the baby bluebird begging, that's my first second clutch of the season. And again, it's 3 weeks later than normal. So those are my earliest birds, and all the other bluebirds I have are just now fledging here the 1st of June. So what's going to happen is they will actually probably miss a brood. Bluebirds normally attempt 2 to 3 broods a season.
Mm-hmm.
So probably what we're going to get is birds only attempting 2 broods. So if there's a drop in, you know, discernible bluebird numbers, that's probably why, because they won't have had time to do 3 broods in a season.
What kind of food were they? Were they waiting for the wildflowers? Were they waiting for that kind of stuff for food, or what?
Well, they're probably, bluebirds, when they are feeding very young babies, are feeding them very soft lepidopteran caterpillars, moths, and butterfly caterpillars.
Uh-huh.
And they were not finding that kind of stuff. And it could well have been that they were not finding enough food for themselves to feel, you know, like the hen, to feel fortified enough that she could even lay eggs. So that's probably what was going on, is that the adults were just barely making it themselves, and they were like, I'm not going to start a nest with this going on. So they had to wait until insects were abundant enough for them to feel confident that they could even lay eggs.
We're talking with naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zikafus. She is talking by phone from her place down in Southeast Ohio, or Southern Ohio, I should say. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about spring birding right now and just spring in general. Yay! This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking birds and nature with naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zikafus. If you want to see all the books she's written many and illustrated them beautifully as well. Check out her website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link to it there. Thanks again, Julie Zikafus, for joining us today.
Oh, it's so great to be back. And I just, you know, we were talking all the dire stuff about spring, but my gosh, this June that's coming on is just amazing.
What a weekend it was, right?
Yeah, just incredible. I've been planting and planting and planting and just getting everything just so.
You're traveling a lot, too?
You know, it's beginning to calm down. I do leave Wednesday for Chicago, where I'll be giving two public lectures and a two-day workshop in creativity and drawing and writing at the Morton Arboretum coming weekend.
Let's talk a little bit about the migration and how that went this spring. Was that delayed as well?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was kind of a wild migration. It was cool. What happened was sort of nothing, and then this bam, this huge wave of birds, and it was stunning. I happened to be in a really good spot to observe the waves of warblers coming through. I was up at McGee Marsh in May for the biggest week in American birding. Mm-hmm. I was giving a talk up there, and oh my goodness, the Thursday, the 10th of May was just dripping with warblers up along the boardwalk at McGee Marsh. It was incredible.
So it delayed, but then it changed what it was like.
Yeah. It basically compressed migration to more birds later. And there were some all-time spectacular counts of birds in Canada coming through a migration point that were in the tens of thousands of birds just pouring through. So basically the birds kind of stacked up down south, and because the weather was just so not conducive, you know, there were fronts coming down from the north that were pushing the birds back and keeping them from flying. And then when they finally could, it was like a floodgate being released.
Carolina wrens?
Carolina wrens are residents wherever they occur, mm-hmm. so they don't migrate. And they usually start initiating nesting very early because they use hidey holes and cavities that are protected from weather.
Baby bird season, though. We talked about bluebirds. What else have you seen?
Well, I'm hearing for the first time newly fledged baby downy woodpeckers this morning.
What do they sound like?
They go beep, 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 beep. Pretty insistent. And they're just beginning to follow their parents around. I think they just came out of the cavity this morning. You know, there have been a couple of derechos in a row, lesser ones than the May 15. Mm-hmm. Or I shouldn't probably call them derechos. The May 15 one definitely was. That was a storm that swept from the Midwest all the way to the coast and just wreaked havoc all the way along. Mm-hmm. A derecho, by definition, is a very strong, violent storm that maintains its power for hundreds of miles. And this thing went, you know, was still raging as it toppled trees on the Jersey and New England coast and then went out to sea. But those derechos are tough because they toss bird nests out of the trees. And that's what's happened two times in a row. So I don't think my robins in my yard have managed to bring a brood off yet. They were probably just about to hatch when the one hit on May 15th, and then there was another one. And I keep seeing her carrying nesting material. Oh. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, honey.
Rebuilding again.
Not your spring. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, did I see you post something on Facebook about that you were kind of taking the phone off the hook? There were so many calls for rescues.
Yeah. It gets kind of intense when you have, you know, 4,000 friends, mm-hmm. and every one of them like knows somebody who has a baby bird. And then there's the tagging that goes on social media. Julie Zickenfuss, you can help. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. ah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I had to back away from social media because, I mean, there's an endless need for advice on wildlife and baby birds. And when you're like, you feel like the lone soldier that everybody's turning to, it gets very overwhelming.
There's a good outfit in Central Ohio, right, that you refer people to?
The Ohio Wildlife Center, I give them a shout-out every chance I can, mm-hmm. because they're hard-working people with a whole net of volunteers. And I'm technically one of their volunteers, you know, although I hold my own state and federal permits to do rehab. They take in thousands, like upwards of 3,000 creatures every season. And they do their best, and they are on the phones all day long advising people what to do, put it back, you know, this kind of thing. And the trick is, you know, with every person that contacts you, you've got to figure out what the problem actually is. You got to figure out what they've got. You have to ask them where they are. You have to find out what has happened, why they think this bird is orphaned, you know. And cell phones are a great boon because you can say, send me a photo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got many, many, many questions answered as to whether it's actually injured or just young. So there, it's time consuming.
By the way, you wrote a nice ode to your cell phone the other day. Your
yeah.
iPhone 6.
Yeah, you know, I drowned it. I've tried to drown it twice, and this time I succeeded. So I was, you know, it was a classic Zikafoos moment. I carry my cell phone and my little metal notebook in this thing called a bandy around my waist.
Mm-hmm.
It's this beautiful little elastic pouch that, you know, has all this thing stuff in it that I need, like Kleenex and my notes and my phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm down by my fish pond, and I'm bending over, like, really, really low to get my nose down to the water level so I can smell the first water lily of the season. And I hear this boop. And what happened, yeah, I have this thing I call my flubber roll around the middle. We all have those.
Mm-hmm.
And it pushed my phone out of the elastic pouch, and boop, into the pond it went. And I caught it, and I ran upstairs sucking on the ports, which was probably a bad idea medically, but I'm okay. And I sucked the water out of the ports. I threw it in rice, 36 hours, still acting wonky, so I had to replace it. You know, it's just a first world problem.
You know, I was surprised, though, because when I look at all of your beautiful photographs, I assume you're using your super fancy camera, but you use your phone a lot.
I am. The camera is an iPhone 6.
Yeah.
Is the most sophisticated, magnificent machine that anyone could ever need, and it's just, I can't sing its praises. I mean, to have this thing in your pocket that you can take these photos with is, to me, it's like, this is the best time to be alive in the world. I love it. So when
this is not Tech Tuesday, folks. This is,
I know.
We're talking with naturalist Julie Zikafoos.
I could have upgraded, you know, to an 8 or a 10, but I was like, nope, this is plenty. This camera is just genius. So I got another
so
six,
there you
and I'm
go.
Having fun with it. Yeah.
You wrote something. You wrote a beautiful story just about the persimmons, and I do want to talk about those. You said, "Well, how did I ever get to be 59 without seeing a persimmon flower?"
Right.
And I wondered that too. But then you made the point that, well, that's the way the tree grows.
Yeah.
This,
and I'm thinking a lot about this, is this all taps into this concept of situational awareness, which I am going to haul off and write a book about, because situational awareness is, in sort of slang parlance, is figuring out what's cool. Basically, it's being aware of stuff going on around you in space and time and assigning significance to the events, the things you hear, the things you smell, the things you see. And so, like, somebody like an air traffic controller needs high situational awareness. They've got to be aware that that action A has consequence Z. You know, it's like, oh, if that plane's coming in on that trajectory, then it's going to hit this plane, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when you take situational awareness, high situational awareness out in nature, and you hear bees humming, and you follow the sound to a little grove of trees, and you've already identified these as persimmons, and you go, oh, my gosh, they must be in bloom. And then you sort back through your memory banks, and you realize you've never seen a persimmon flower. And why would that be? Because these things are usually 40 to 50 feet tall, and they don't have branches in the lower parts when they're older. And so you don't get to see those flowers because that's happening 50 feet overhead. So I found these young persimmons in bloom, and I just about fell to my knees because I was so excited to finally see the flower of a persimmon.
And smell it.
Yeah, which actually I was kind of bummed it didn't smell much at all. But so I got very excited about that, and I posted photos of the flowers, and I had very experienced botanists saying, I've never seen this. And that was cool because it links back into this situational awareness of, like, being aware enough to know when something is special. So when you get to see a persimmon flower for the first time, it's a red-letter day for a naturalist.
I was walking along the bike path here, and it looked like a lot of little bugs crawling across the path. But then I realized they're all going in the same direction.
Cool.
And there were these tiny little, I mean tiny, like the size of my fingernail or smaller, mm-hmm. frogs.
Oh, my goodness.
And they must have just hatched, and there were hundreds of them.
Well, they would have just metamorphosed.
Right, yeah, right.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
Yeah, they would have hatched as tadpoles and then metamorphosed.
Right.
Were they blackish?
No, they were brownish.
Brownish?
Greenish.
Okay.
Brownish.
Mm.
Yeah,
well,
anyways, you just made me think about being aware.
Yeah.
And instead of just assuming they were bugs, because they were so small, you had to kneel down and get very close to the ground to see
right.
them.
Right. I wonder if they were maybe spring peepers.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And then I was just glad later on it was going to rain, and I was just glad because people were going to get off the bike path.
Right, right, and not smush them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there are certain people who might have set up camp there with the with the frogs.
There are certain people.
Stopped traffic. Yeah.
Well, I had a dog, so, you know.
I hear you.
You know, who thinks chasing bugs is fun, so I didn't want her doing that to the little baby teeny weeny frogs.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It was cool. Hey, Barbara and Gahanna, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. We are overrun with skunks in Gahanna right now, and I've had to take down all of my bird feeders because when the birds knock the seeds on the ground, it attracts the skunks. And I have a question for Julie about some kind of a powder, like a chili powder or something that you can put in the bird seed that doesn't harm the birds, but it would keep the skunks away. Are you familiar with anything like that?
I've seen a lot of manufacturers putting out bird seed that has capsaicin in it, which is the oil from chili peppers. I am not a huge fan of that because capsaicin, while birds can tolerate it, when it gets into the mucous membranes like the eyes, that hurts them.
Like it
and,
stings, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Like when you're cutting a chili pepper and
yeah.
you rub your eyes.
Whoops. Right.
Yeah. So birds are not as sensitive to it as mammals. Overrun with skunks is, I mean, I understand that that can be a problem when you have dogs who go out and tangle with them. And I don't know. I suppose that it could work, but it's not a solution that I'd go for myself, knowing how powerful capsaicin is and, the potential harm to the birds also.
You know, I've heard elsewhere that it's a big year for skunks. What?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that might be, if indeed it is?
I don't know a lot about it. I mean, I've been looking at photographing, studying skunks here for years, and I will say I'm a huge fan. I really, really like skunks. They're smart. They're really appealing creatures. I've been sprayed twice, so I'm not like, I don't pretend that they don't have their issues. But I don't really know what governs sudden explosions in skunks. I would guess that it's related to food abundance.
Hmm.
Skunks are attracted to birdseed, but they're much more insectivores. They're digging for Japanese beetles in your lawn. They're the larvae of Japanese beetles. They're digging for June bug larvae. They're largely insectivores. They eat a lot of insects. If you look at skunk droppings, they're made up almost entirely of beetle elytra, the wing covers of beetles. So they are, I would consider, a beneficial animal. But I also, having owned a dog, understand completely how tough it is to not be able to let your dog out without it, you know, running into a skunk. So I'm not sure about the link between the bird seed and the skunks. If you stop feeding birds, you'll stop getting skunks. They may be digging for other things in your lawn as well.
Okay. Barbara, thanks for that call. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've talked about this before, but it always bears repeating the question of why we grew up being told to stay away from birds' nests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and it's an old wives' tale that if you touch a baby bird, the mother will never care for it again,
mm-hmm.
Because mother birds are so bonded to their to their offspring that it takes a lot more than knowing a person has touched the bird to keep them from, you know, caring for their young. It's probably a good thing that most of us believe that because it keeps us from poking around in birds' nests, which is something we shouldn't be doing, unless we know exactly what we're doing. Birds have a no sense of smell, particularly songbirds, so they are not going to smell you on their young. A little bit of intervention is sometimes needed, you know, to when I'm checking my boxes and cleaning the nest, and the birds don't mind that at all. But, you know, what you don't want to do is walk up to a bird's nest like a robin's nest or a song sparrow in your shrubbery, handle the babies, because what will happen is a predator will follow your scent and clean that nest out. So that's sort of the source of it, of that old wives' tale, is that, you know, if you do handle baby birds and mess with them, often they will disappear very quickly because predator has followed you.
Well, you mentioned song sparrow, and we happen to have some sound from a song sparrow, so why don't we listen to that? Okay, I heard like 10 different birds. You probably heard like 50.
There were a lot of birds in there. Yeah.
It was delightful.
Yeah, song sparrows are just very much underrated singers. I really enjoy them. One of the things I really like to listen with song sparrows is the way they switch around their repertoire. They will have a song that they'll sing for a while, and then they'll switch to a different one. And I have one right now on my property that I call Alphabets because he sings the alphabet song. He sings A, B, C, D, E, F, 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 F. I just adore him, and this is his second year with me, so I really, really love him. But that said, he has many other, songs that he sings.
You know, you mentioned that particularly songbirds have no sense of smell. Do we know why?
They probably because they don't really need one. They find birds are supremely visual creatures, so they find their food by seeing it usually.
Yeah, and I always wonder what are they seeing? I mean, have they learned to respond to bird feeders?
Oh gosh, yes.
Birds
copy birds basically. So if a bird is flying by and it sees a bunch of birds gathered at a feeder, it'll go, "Huh, I wonder what that's all about." And so they observe each other. One of my favorite photos I have, I call A Few Red Birds, and I've got a large sunflower seed feeder, and on it are a couple of cardinals and a red-bellied woodpecker, both of which have a lot of red on them.
Uh-huh.
And sitting on top of the feeder is a scarlet tanager, a male, resplendent, absolutely crimson red with black wings and tail, and he's sitting there going, "Huh, wonder what this is all about." But the reason that photo is funny to me is that a scarlet tanager is an obligate insectivore. He's not going to eat seeds at all.
Mm-hmm.
But being a bird, he's curious, he's innovative, and he's wondering if there's something there for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's come in to investigate what all those other birds are eating.
And this is a photograph you took?
Yes. Yes.
We will continue our conversation with Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, and author. We'll have a link to her website on ours at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for her, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zickafoos. Questions or comments, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Julie, when baby birds are growing, there's more to it than just the physical, the outward manifestation. There's a lot going on mentally, intellectually?
Absolutely.
Like what?
Well, there's a moment in songbird development that I call the moment of sentience, where and I find this so interesting, where a young bird that has formerly been very comfortable with being handled, peeked in on in the nest box, where, you know, when I'm monitoring my boxes, I'm checking these boxes to make sure everything is okay. All of a sudden, right around the age of 12 to 13 days for a bluebird, for instance, is a moment when they look at me and realize that I'm not benign, and that they are birds and I am not. And it's so interesting. And also in rehab, I see this in birds, where if you take in a baby bird that's right around, you know, 12, 13 days of age before fledging, but when they're beginning to get jumpy and fidgety, they can be very hard to feed because they're afraid of you. And they won't open their mouths for you, and it makes it a little more difficult. Then you have to win their trust. And in many cases, you have to start off force feeding them until they get the idea that you are benign and you're taking care of them and you're their mom now. So it's very interesting. So, yeah, there are mental changes that accompany fledging as well as physical changes, which are profound.
Let's see. Peter in Worthington, you're on the air with Julie Zicafus. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a friend in Sunbury who has quite a large property, and he has a lot of mosquitoes. So I suggested he should put up a big pole and put a bird's nest up there with, you know, 20 boxes or so, and try to attract purple martins. I just wondered if that's possible, if they eat mosquitoes or if they would help him alleviate his problem.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, Peter. There was a fellow named Ward who in the 1960s and 70s made himself quite famous by promoting purple martin boxes as the ultimate deterrent to mosquitoes, where if you put these up in your yard, you'll get these marvelous birds who will eat all your mosquitoes. And he even had claims like each bird eats 10,000 mosquitoes a day. Well, the problem with that claim is that when you collect and dissect purple martins, or for instance, you set up with a camera and you take pictures of what they're bringing into their young, they're largely eating dragonflies. Mm. So purple martins tend to occur near bodies of water where they can catch dragonflies. Purple martins are big birds. They're our largest swallow, so they cannot exist on an insect as small and filmy as a mosquito. They actually need big, crunchy insects. So that's actually an old wives' tale. But there are many, many good reasons to put up purple martin boxes, such as promoting this, you know, endangered, not endangered, but certainly declining species with good housing.
What about bats for mosquitoes?
Bats are much more to the point as far as mosquito control. Yes.
Yeah.
And bats suffer from bad PR, mm-hmm. and are very underappreciated in their importance in controlling many crop pests and mosquitoes as well.
Jane in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. Thanks so much. I am just loving your show today. I stopped everything, and I'm just listening to every word.
Thank you.
But in the wintertime especially, I've gotten that I have an electric dog dish, and I have fresh water for the birds and squirrels. And they, with this harsh winter we had, I have many more squirrels, mourning doves, which I love, and all types of birds, more than I've ever seen before and can identify. But now I'm feeding them much more than I used to, and I'm attracting way more. And I'd like to cut back on the food, but I feel guilty. What do you do about the guilty factor?
Jane, I'm going to give you permission to cut back. Yeah. Sometimes all we need is a little
more
permission.
I'm trying to grow things that are pollinators. Yeah. And, of course, that stuff hasn't come up yet. So yep. I know they're going to get different sources. But,
your birds are going to be fine. I think the thing to remember, and I have the same dilemma that you do, and I've had to cut back my bird feeding a lot lately because I have some very rapacious raccoons who have until now like foiled everything that I've tried to baffle them with. It's actually been hilarious, and I've been documenting it in both videos and photos, and I'm going to be blogging about that. But the nice part is that it's forced me to feed a lot less and to target just the small finches that will eat thistle seed and that will feed from feeders that I can baffle from the raccoons. So I've done the same thing you have, and it's only natural to cut back on bird feeding in summer because there is such an abundant insect population now.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing to realize is that there are only a few birds that feed their young seeds, and those include goldfinches, house finches, and some of the woodpeckers. All the other birds, like cardinals and blue jays, and of course, all the woodland birds like tanagers and vireos, they're all feeding their young insects this time of year. So there's really nothing you're putting out that's going to help them. And yeah, sure, the cardinals will come and sort of gorge on seed, but they're feeding their young insects. So you can safely cut back without guilt, and I would keep it at a level that you're comfortable with. I don't think it's ever good to flood an area with so much food that you get unnatural abundances of any creature. When I do that, I have so many squirrels. Like last summer, I had like 9 squirrels under my feeders.
Mm-hmm.
And it was oppressive because they do other stuff like chew up my potted plants and, mm-hmm. you know, dig and stuff. And then I had a bobcat come in. And then I didn't have any squirrels.
It attracted other predators.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was actually very cool. So I'm going into my third year here. And I'm hoping that I get my mid-August bobcat. I've had 2 different individuals come into the yard and hunt me clean and then leave. So
it's like wild kingdom out there.
It is. It is. Southeast Ohio is like paradise.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Got some other calls we're going to get to. But before, I don't want to let you run away, Julie Zickafoos, without talking about Jemima, the blue jay.
Yeah.
A natural history cinematographer came out to shoot footage.
Yeah.
It aired on PBS in April. Before we talk about Jemima, let's hear the common call of a blue jay. Okay. Jemima, of course, was the little gal you raised from baby bird.
Yeah, yeah, and she was a great, great gift. Jemima was my last summer. She was the summer of 2017,
mm-hmm.
and I have finished writing Saving Jemima.
Oh.
And I know, and this summer I'm illustrating it, and I'm going to start, mark my words, as soon as I get back from Chicago. This coming weekend.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. Mostly going to be illustrated with photographs published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Jemima has not been seen since December 24th.
Wow.
She left with her band and has not reappeared. I don't know what's happened to her, but I have let her go. And I'm choosing to savor that amazing 8 months that I was privileged to be part of her life.
So what did he shoot when he came in?
He came in mid-June.
Oh, okay.
2017, and he shot footage of Jemima eating painted lady caterpillars that I had raised here in the house, and we put them on tree branches. I had trained her to come to this certain place to eat them, and the footage was used in a special on the PBS Nature called Sex, Lies, and Butterflies.
Oh, okay.
And the cinematographer was Mark Carroll, and he was working with Coneflower Studios, which is headed up by the brilliant Anne Prum. And Anne had seen my Instagram post about this baby blue jay and put 2 and 2 together and realized that this blue jay might be the ideal predator for her special on caterpillars. And so it was not easy, but we made it happen, and Jemima is now in that special. There's about, 30-second, clip of her.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was, eating these caterpillars, and it's just hilarious. So, yeah, a big thrill.
Dick and Gahanna, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Nice to talk with you, Julie.
Nice.
I wanted to ask about a Cooper's hawk that I watched a couple of years ago. in very early spring, around February. She had several perches, each about 10 feet off the ground, surrounding a lawn. And she would watch for a while and then dive down to the lawn, make a controlled landing, and peck like a chicken for a while. And then back to another perch and watch for a while and repeat the whole thing. Is that a normal behavior for a hawk?
That's odd. It sounds to me like it was trying to grab something. I haven't actually seen a Cooper's hawk do that. I see them make these sort of strafing flights and in which they either grab a junco or they don't. But I have not seen a Cooper's hawk peck like a chicken in the ground.
It's been quite a while at it. It was a couple hours.
That's interesting. Did you ever see it eat anything?
I assumed that it was getting something each time it pecked, but I don't know that. I wasn't close enough to watch it swallow or anything.
That's really interesting. A snowy owl I was watching this winter would swoop down, grab a bunch of grass with its talons. You know, presumably it had heard something in there that it was trying to get. And then it would sort through what it had grabbed and come up with nothing and then fly back to a perch. So, you know, that was the bird thinking it had something and then it didn't. So that would be one suggestion, but I suppose it is possible that there was some insect prey that it was after. But for a Cooper's hawk, which is a bird specialist, that would definitely be a desperation move to eat insects. It would be.
Yeah, I have seen them swoop down and grab things.
Yeah.
This was nothing like that.
Right.
It was a controlled landing and then back at the ground.
Weird. Was it an adult bird in the adult plumage or immature?
It appeared to me to be an adult.
Like the blue back and the red eyes?
I couldn't see the eyes.
So reddish underparts and bluish gray back.
Yeah.
I don't know. You stumped me. Stump the expert. You win.
Dick stumped Julie Zickafoos. Dick,
happens.
Thanks for that call. I don't think I've ever stumped you. Well, not that I would. I mean, I
look forward to that day. I love to
I stump. Can't even imagine. No. So, Dick, thanks a lot for that call. You know, you talked about a bird that changes a lot. I can't remember which one it was. The house wren or... anyways, changes its call and sings.
Song sparrows, yeah.
Song sparrows.
Repertoire. Mm-hmm.
Is that a common thing or is that unique?
Yeah, that's fairly typical
of
a bird to have sort of a selection of songs. And the birds that take that to an extreme would be the mimids, the mockingbird, the brown thrasher, or the catbird, where they have like a library of songs that they know and that they recite. And, you know, there are a lot of people who do, like, these little puzzles, like Sudoku, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine is listening to mockingbirds and writing down everything that they sing. And, let me give you, here's one that I was listening to yesterday. When I hear a mockingbird singing, I will often sit down.
Okay, you have a minute.
Okay,
go ahead.
So, flicker, bluebird, blue jay, flicker, tanager. Belted kingfisher, American robin, northern mockingbird, blue jay, flicker, blue jay, tufted titmouse, wood thrush, pileated woodpecker, Carolina wren, eastern phoebe, gray catbird, flicker, wood thrush. So these were the birds that this thing was imitating in rapid succession. And this is how I keep my aging brain mobile. I'll write down everything I hear. But the avian brain is such a magical thing that this bird has this stored repertoire. And they will often, like, they'll do bluebird, they'll do every call of a juvenile, and then they'll move through every call of the adult. Like, here's what I know about bluebird. Incredible.
Julie Zickafoos, you're incredible. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Wonderful to be with you, Anne. Thank you.
Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, and author, a forthcoming book about Jemima. The Blue Jay coming up. We'll be talking about that, I hope, in coming months. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.